Good morning. This is Tracy Hales-Bass with Right on Four Corners. Today, I'm interviewing Scott Graham, the author of The National Park Mysteries. Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Good to talk to you.
I really enjoyed reading Yosemite Fall.
Well, I enjoyed writing it, so I'm glad to hear you enjoyed it, too.
It seemed like it would be fun to write.
Yeah, certainly the idea of my books, my series, and certainly Yosemite Fall. The kind of job one is to, when you're writing mysteries, is to hopefully write something that's going to be entertaining and fun for the reader. And I've found that if I'm enjoying the writing process, then more certain that it's going to be an enjoyable read for people as well.
Right. I really like the couple, Chuck Bender and his wife, Janelle Ortega.
Thank you.
She's a really strong character, which I always like to see strong women in these books.
Yep, and I've been having fun making her a strong woman. She starts out, and Chuck is a bit clueless, and he's not willing to cede some of that ground. And it's been a fun process for me through the series to have Chuck hopefully grow a little bit as an individual, and as a result, allow Janelle to be the person she is. And that's part of the fun process, I think, of writing a series. Is that you get to let these characters develop over time. And I'm proud of kind of the person that I'm seeing Janelle become. I mean, it's the person she's been all along, but in the relationship now, she's being able to assert herself more. I've tried to make it as real as possible in that regard.
Yeah, they both seem to be very real. And she
Great.
Is a paramedic student, and he's an archaeologist.
That's correct.
Now, he's also a mountain climber. Are you also a mountain climber?
Well, I was raised in Durango in the Four Corners area, and so all of us in this area have kind of got mountains in our blood. And
yes.
So, yep, I've certainly spent a lot of time in the mountains. I've done rock climbing on my own. I still mess around a little bit on rock walls with my kids and whatnot, but I don't do serious rock climbing like I have my character Chuck in this book having done in the past. I did
right.
a little bit more serious rock climbing in the past, but nothing to the level that he claims to have done, so I'm taking what I know, but also then going a little further with Chuck,
yeah.
which lends itself to the Yosemite story. I mean, it kind
right.
of is what brings him back to Yosemite. It gives that story storyline that then I follow through with.
Well, why don't you cue our listeners in on a summation of the National Parks Mystery Series?
Sure. The summation of the series is that what we've got is Chuck Bender, an archaeologist, private contractor who goes around and does archaeological contract work at various national parks, and then at each national park he tends to bring his what has been a new family for him, and then over the years as the series has progressed, it's a family now that is becoming a more seasoned family together. He brings them along, and then the dead bodies of course begin to pile up as they have a want to do in murder mysteries.
Right.
And it falls to Chuck and his wife Janelle and the family dynamic to deal with the calamitous events that then occur. And then what we've got basically is the classic amateur sleuth series where for contrived reasons the authorities aren't taking care of the mounting death toll, and so it falls to our amateur sleuths in this case to solve the crime. And so the goal of the series then is to introduce to readers the place that is each national park in which that series entry is set, and give the reader a fun, interesting way of learning about that park and learning about some of the challenges and issues that are affecting that park. So kind of the goal is for it to be somewhat of a twofer, that you've kind of got a fun mystery,
mm-hmm.
a fun series, but also a serious take on this is what this national park is. These are some of the challenges this national park faces.
And what are the other national parks you covered?
So the first book 4 years ago was Canyon Sacrifice. And then book number two, 3 years ago, was Mountain Rampage. And then 2 years ago was Yellowstone Standoff. So we kept going north, went on up to Yellowstone, lots of bears, lots of wolves
wow.
in that one. And then went out west to Yosemite National Park and Yosemite Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And this year's Yosemite Fall. And then next year, I'm just finishing up, will be Arches. Enemy,
oh.
that, of course, in Arches National Park.
Great. I look forward to that one, too.
And I'm just setting off working on, I will say, getting to work on Mesa Verde Victim. So I'm finally bringing
oh.
it home to right to the Four Corners.
All
so
right.
Mesa Verde Victim will be, what'll that be, 2020.
That's great.
That's the one I'm starting on now. You kind of end up working 2 years in advance
right.
on your series books. And they want to come out, the publisher seeks to have murder mysteries generally come out once a year so that you have an audience that builds over time and has the expectation that kind of once a year you've got another saga to that unfolds.
And looking forward to the next one.
Right? Yeah.
And again, how a couple evolves.
Right. It's fun. It's really been a fun. I'm glad that you brought that up right away because that's been a fun and really challenging piece of it for me. I know the parks. I go visit these parks and really love the parks. So, and I'm a journalist by trade and by training. And mm-hmm. so the telling about the park and the plot and the storyline are something that is more something that is comfortably to me and has come comfortably to me. Character building is something that I've had to work on. It's been a skill that I've had to develop in myself. And so I'm glad to hear that you are recognizing the fact that these are some real people, real characters, because that's been the piece that I wanted to tackle. That's one of the reasons that's so fun about fiction writing, is that you are deeper into characters and creating these worlds with people that you hope for have a sense of reality to them. And yet, that's the scary part of it, too, for those of us
right.
who have dabbled primarily in nonfiction. And so
right.
I'm glad to hear that you're seeing some development of my characters in the book. And it's certainly something that I've sought to do and has been perhaps the single biggest challenge of what I've been trying to do with the series.
Well, there are actually quite a few characters other than the two protagonists and their children. But you've got a slew of these climbers, and you describe them really well, and each of them has his own quirk and weirdness or uniqueness to them.
And that I'm glad to hear you talking about that too, because that's another of the challenges. If people that are listening to this like mysteries, the mystery is a genre,
uh-huh.
what we call a genre source type of fiction, and genre fiction by definition has somewhat of a template to it. There is an expectation by the reader that, okay, I'm reading this genre, I know what the expectation of this genre is, and so almost by definition, the author going into, you can play with some of the template, of course, that's the goal, you want to push the envelope a little bit and whatnot, but in general, there are these various specific expectations that
right.
have become expectations, that have become part of the template because they work, right?
Right.
So one of those is that when you're reading a mystery, in the same way that we watch a movie, and a two-hour movie, you know that at about an hour and a half is going to be the low point of the movie, and then you come out of it to the whatever the shining ending is
right.
for your classic Hollywood movie, right?
Right.
In a mystery, the way a mystery works best is you have to have between 4 and 6 good, solid suspects.
Mm-hmm.
If you have more than 6, the reader can't hold that many suspects in their head. If you have fewer than 4, then it's too easy to guess who done it. So generally the best mysteries have the template is that you've got kind of 4 to 6 suspects of who done it. And so in general, what you'll see as you start out a mystery is that the author has set up some group of people that are gathered for some reason. So in the situation of Yosemite Fall, then we have got Chuck Bender's former colleagues who were all rock climbers who have gotten back together in historic Camp 4 campground in Yosemite Valley to kind of relive, have a weekend reunion where they're all back together and talking old times. And so now you've got this gathered group of people, and among those, then you develop 4 to 6 of them who hopefully, like you said, stand out as individuals, but each of whom could conceivably be doing the bad things that are now suddenly beginning to occur as the story unfolds.
Yet you're always surprised at when you find out who did do it.
That's the goal.
Right.
And so in my case, what I've ended up having to do is I think I know who has done it. And when I write my first draft, because I'm not a good outliner, I tend to
mm-hmm.
just write and see what happens. I'm finding out what happens as it happens.
Right.
But if I've got a sense, I found each time, if I've got a sense of who's done it, who I think has done it, I end up telegraphing a little bit too much that is the bad guy or bad gal or whatever. And so in 3 of the 4, I think it is, I've had to actually go back and rewrite. After I get done with the brush draft, I literally go back and change the bad person. I change the killer because subconsciously directed too much attention to the real killer.
You've given
and
him
so,
away.
Yeah, and I found actually that works really well because it does. It adds a layer of surprise. It enables me to go back in and add some twists and turns. And so it's been a very successful process as a result. Whereas the first time that happened, when people read my first draft of my first one and said, well, I saw who the killer was way back when, I was really put off. I was like, oh, that wasn't supposed to happen. And now I accept it as part of my process.
Oh, that's a good way to revise.
Yeah, it actually
I like
is.
that.
And as long as you accept the idea that when it, especially when it comes to fiction, everything is revisable, and that
right.
is part of the process. The
yes.
rewrite then the rewriting becomes more fun as opposed to more terrifying. And the rewriting, if you accept it that way, becomes the most fun part. It
right.
has become that for me with these. The first draft, I tend to try to just push them out, and it's hard work. And, of course, all of this is hard work in a really enjoyable way. But that first draft, because there are so many moving parts, but then once you get to the rewrite, no matter how terrible portions of that first draft are, you can see the repair work that you're able to do. And it's such a relief. I have yet to have gotten to a point where what I've written as a first draft is unrepairable. At that point, I guess, and of course that happens, I think, with certain novels where people create something that just doesn't, is beyond repair.
So
far, with what I've been doing, I think because I'm doing mysteries, I'm following a template. There's a certain plot line kind of understood.
Right.
Everything I've then come back to, I can see as I read it how terrible it is, but also how repairable it is.
Right.
And so that's made the rewriting process, as you said, really enjoyable as opposed to a chore.
And it makes the drafting process easier too, because you know it's going to get fixed if it's not working.
Aren't you right? You're absolutely right about that. You know, all of us in this world, one of the things we all want to do is be that completely confident person. But the reality is, when you're trying something new in life, the confidence is something that has to be built over time. And I have certainly seen that and that's another fun thing about writing a series, is that you learn as you go. And I'm not a young guy. I'm well into my 50s. But this 5-year process of doing this series has been a tremendous learning experience for me. And one of the pieces that I've gained from it is confidence in a new area that I didn't have before. Going into this, I was a confident nonfiction writer. I was a confident journalist. I was a confident editor for others. I could see problems in other people's work. I could
Right.
produce good nonfiction work. But fiction was new to me. And so going into this was frightening, and I lacked confidence. And I will be honest, I think it shows in the first couple of books I wrote. But I believe that confidence has come along, and the quality of my work is improving as a result. Because like any time, when you're more confident in what you're doing, you are better at what you're doing as well. And
That's
so it's
true.
Been a wonderful growing experience, but that confidence is a key part of it.
Well, why don't you read for us a little bit so we can see how confident you are in this one?
Yeah, well, there you go. This is. I'll give you a taste of the start of Yosemite Fall.
Great.
This is a kind of an edited version of the prologue, a couple minutes long. And what we've got, you'll see, is the kind of the opening sequence of that sets up the rest of the book. So the rest of the book goes into Chuck Bender's mind, is told from his perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The first is written in what we call third person omniscient. So we're in the moment of a wingsuit flyer is getting ready to fly off one of the cliffs in Yosemite Valley. If people can picture what those wingsuit climbers are. So it begins here. Dawn, a good time to cheat death. He faced north in his wingsuit, his feet planted on the lip of Glacier Point, half a vertical mile above the shadowed Yosemite Valley floor. The sun edged above the serrated peaks of the High Sierra to the east. Its slanted rays stirred the first of the morning's updrafts, peak precursors of the blustery, hot summer day to come. He flexed his toes in his padded landing shoes, his arms pressed to his sides. The fabric airfoils of his flying suit flapped at his elbows and between his legs. He was a small man at 5'6" and 150 pounds, still heavily muscled as he neared 50, abs six-packed, biceps and forearms honed from decades of scaling El Capitan, Half Dome, and the dozens of other sheer granite faces walling the valley before him. He took a steadying breath and focused inward, seeking calm and the supreme confidence required to leap into the abyss below. He looked left, focusing on the dark gap in Sentinel Ridge. He hadn't yet determined if he would enter the narrow slot, a flying dart threading the rock-walled breach at 120 miles an hour. He couldn't decide, in fact, until he dropped into the yawning void and the first of the day's rising thermals gathered in his wings. Still, having curled away from the notch his previous three flights, the need to rocket through it sometime soon, as this end of summer drew near, was growing impossible to ignore. The sun bathed the topmost reaches of El Capitan, opposite him in orange and red. His eyes tracked to the shadowed base of El Cap's 3,000-foot face, where the gravel Camp 4 parking lot, his triumphal landing spot, formed a smoky gray rectangle on the flat valley floor. His stomach fluttered at the notion of his surprise landing in the Camp 4 lot. His appearance there in a minute or two from out of the dawn sky would be that of a spirit, a specter, an apparition from beyond. The flecks of quartz at his feet glimmered in the slanted rays of the low sun, as if he stood not on stone but on stardust, poised to fly up and away into the morning light, unencumbered by the bonds of gravity. The setting was perfect. The shimmering lip of stone, his Superman red wingsuit aflame in the day's initial burst of sunlight, his body still and erect, high above the valley floor. He began his silent countdown from five. On three, the pounding of his heart rose from his chest into his throat. On two, he didn't so much lean forward as simply begin the process of falling, his weight shifting out and over the edge of the cliff. On one, he lifted his arms, raising his wings into place. On zero, he bent his knees and leapt off the point of rock. He plummeted straight down, 100 feet, 200, the stone face scant meters away, his arms and legs spread until the air rushing past him filled his airfoils, and he soared away from the wall, a human missile slicing through the sky. He lowered one wrist, then the other, angling left, right, the roar loud as a jet engine in his ears as he shot across the canyon. No gusts of wind buffeted him. The gap? Yes, a go. The need to increase his viewership numbers announcing itself from deep in his cerebral cortex. Bending his spine, his arms and legs fanned wide, he described a sweeping arc and lined up with Sentinel Ridge. He focused through his goggles on the dark notch in front of him, aiming for the narrow break in the forested ridge. The slot, 60 feet wide, angled downward and to his left, requiring a dead center entry and a continued, precise leftward turn its entire length. At 100-plus miles per hour, the slightest deviation would send him rocketing into one or the other of the gap's granite walls. Judging himself too low as he sped toward the notch, he lowered his legs, angling his body upward to catch more air and moderate his gliding descent. The added blast of wind from the maneuver ripped at a loose thread dangling from the airfoil between his legs at the bottom of his suit. The thread popped free from needle hole after needle hole beside his right ankle, lengthening up the seam of his lower airfoil. He bowed his body to initiate his turn as he neared the slot. The force of the maneuver caused the thread to lengthen further, separating the airfoil at its seam and exposing one of the foil's stiff plastic stays. The exposed stay flapped next to his foot like the blurred wing of a hummingbird, setting off an undulating vibration along the bottom hem of the airfoil. The buzzing plastic rod slashed through his sock and bit deep into the skin of his ankle. At the same instant, the vibration along the hem of his wingsuit progressed to his right leg, which bucked violently from ankle to hip and back again. Fear flared white hot in his brain. He tightened his right quadriceps, attempting to still his rocking leg, but it continued its fierce shimmy. As he entered the gap, the intense bucking of his leg caused him to veer wildly out of control. And that's the end of the prologue.
And what a hook that is.
That's the goal, of course, for the
mystery.
Oh,
yeah. There was not a dull moment in it.
That's certainly the idea of mysteries in general, and mine in particular. I mean, I'm trying to, as I say, have fun with them and bring folks along on a ride. We love our national parks because they're fun, exciting places and places of wonder. And so I've tried to design a mystery series that seeks to capture some of that.
That's great.
Thanks.
And you've been to all those and hung out in them, so you're familiar with the landscape and the environment.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the fun, of course, of something like this.
Right.
Yosemite in particular, I went out a couple of times. I had backpacked in the vicinity of Yosemite, but hadn't really spent time in the valley itself, down along the valley floor, because it's a real crowded area, not the sort of place I would normally seek out when I went to a national park.
Right.
But I knew in this instance that that's where I needed to set this, among all of the happenings in the bottom of the valley, and specifically in Camp 4. And so my wife and I went out and spent 3 days bouncing around the valley floor, being in Camp 4 and being jumping on the buses and bouncing around the whole area there so that it could give me in my head a real sense of what I was writing about. And then I went back out a second time and actually went on my own and did research in the Yosemite Library, which they've got this tight little library in the attic of the Yosemite Valley Museum, with one of six paid National Park Service librarians running it. And you sign up in advance, and as a researcher and a member of the public, you can go up there and do research. It was absolutely fascinating, all these old volumes from the past and the development of Yosemite Valley and Yosemite National Park. And then the most fascinating thing, to me at least, was the fact that I was able to visit the Yosemite Archives, which I didn't even know existed until I started my research, which are a separate building sitting inside a massive warehouse down the valley, outside of Yosemite Valley itself, downstream, down the Merced River, in the big maintenance area for the Yosemite National Park and for Yosemite Valley. So you go into this massive warehouse building, and then there's a separate building sitting inside it, climate controlled. You again have set up as a member of the public and a researcher with legitimate research desires and needs, an appointment. You go in there. They give you a down coat. It's a temperature controlled place down in the 50s.
Oh, wow.
White gloves, and you work with the archivist, and they have all the old maps. They have got the blazes that John Muir first put into the trees when he was first setting trails around the valley floor in the forest. And then when those trees grew old or whatever, they cut the blazes out of the trees just to save those. They're just amazing kind of keepsakes that are kind of part of the public domain, part of the public interest, that have been saved and that are in this archive temperature controlled building. That it just blew me away. I had no idea something like that existed. And so that's the fun that you get from getting to research these places.
Oh, absolutely. Is that where you met prospector Stephen F. Grover?
That I found online and then did more research in both those places on him. That was, yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And you have writings from him and also Lafayette Brunel.
That's correct. Yes, and Grover was the one that kind of set me on the track to find Brunel's work and other historical figures who helped open the, you know, you could say the terminology is always difficult in these situations where what we're talking about here is part of what more and more these days is being called the California Genocide, which was the real taking out of the Native American or the indigenous people's population in the Sierras and in the Sierra foothills that came as a result of the Sierra Gold Rush and the California Gold Rush in 1849 and the years that followed. And so the story of Yosemite Valley and the story of Yosemite National Park is all part of that. And that was kind of the social justice and historical issue that I wanted to talk about in the realm of the fun wingsuit flying rock climbing world of Yosemite National Park today, was how Yosemite National Park really came to be. And so I ran across Stephen Grover's diary or journal of his entry into the park as an early gold prospector and two murders that occurred as a result of these eight gold prospectors' entry into the valley at the hands of the Awanichi or Yosemite Valley Indians under the leadership of Chief Tenaya, who were living in the valley at the time, and the ongoing mystery that still exists to this day as to whether those killings by the warriors were a result of bad people among the gold prospectors who wanted these two gold prospectors killed and coerced indigenous people and the Awanichi and Yosemite people into doing the killing for them, or whether it was simply the result of those people in the valley defending their ancestral lands. But in either case, it makes for a wonderful true life mystery that I was then able to explore both through the realm of fiction and reprinting portions of Stephen Grover's journal and Lafayette Brunel's reminiscences of his then follow-up visits to Yosemite Valley.
So you have a murder mystery within a murder mystery.
Exactly right.
And that it works really well.
I appreciate hearing that, because it was that was a challenge that again was a new challenge with this book that I hadn't tried to take on with the earlier books. And so it was kind of an added layer, and I'm glad to hear that you believe it works, because
yes.
I obviously it's been through copious editing and lots of work and lots of other readers, but you do hope that when it gets to the stages now, having just been released, that the readers themselves believe it works, because I was trying to do a lot. And of course, a mystery by definition is a fairly short novel. You don't generally have very long novels, and so I'm trying to pack a lot into a little space. So I'm glad to hear that you feel it worked.
It did work. The pacing is great. It was one of those can't put down books.
Wonderful. That's the goal, at least as far as I'm concerned, of the mysteries that I write.
Right.
I'm aiming in them at mystery readers who tend to be folks who just like fast pace, and that's what I've always read. I love a good mystery, and I love particularly those mysteries that have a lot going on. I
yes.
like a good, strong, moving plot, and so that's what I've tried to do with mine as well, because it's what I like and what I believe. You know, it's a big part of what makes mystery the best-selling genre, literally on Earth. I mean, that's what people love the most to read when it comes to genre fiction.
Right, and the girls are great. Carmelita and Rosie, yes.
That's right.
And then we've got the story of Carmelita trying her hand at the climb.
Yes, and again, in the same way that I'm trying to develop these characters and let them grow over time, Carmelita is one who I'm enjoying letting grow over time, but more at a young age. She's mm-hmm. going through adolescence. She's trying to find herself. And one of the ways she happens to find herself in Yosemite Fall is that she discovers by getting to try out the sport that she's kind of a wonderkind when it comes to rock climbing, which again is pulled right from the real life. You've got these adolescent kids now out there who are some of the best rock climbers on earth because their strength to weight ratio is literally off the charts.
Right.
And so if you've got ones that they've got a tremendous sense of balance, they can be better than people who have been climbing on big walls and rock walls for decades because they're at that right age. Not unlike gymnasts, you know, how
right.
gymnasts are tend to be young because that's when you've got the right ratio. And then you also just have no fear. So I've let her be that representative of that real class of young people who are out there now.
Is she going to continue her climbing?
Absolutely, yeah.
Good.
Because she's, as you know, having read the book, she's now living in the Four Corners. I've got her and the family based out of Durango,
mm-hmm.
and so Janelle has come to Durango from Albuquerque. I've got the family in the area where, of course, rock climbing is part and parcel of who and what our community is, and so that will figure into future books and into some of the, of course, many of us who have got young offspring who are climbing around us, fears that play into that as parents. I've
right.
got a couple of young men who are my sons who now are rock climbers, and I'm thinking, why did I introduce that?
Exactly. Cringe.
Precisely. And yet, you know, we have to introduce our kids to the world, and here in the Four Corners, that's one of the ways we
it
do
is.
It is. Introduce them to the outdoors. And there are dangers everywhere in the world, and so that's part of what we have to, I think, understand as parents. And so I've got that going on. In other words, yes, in Carmelita, I'll be playing some of my own fears through Chuck as
Good.
She grows older.
And your wife is an emergency physician, so
that is
I can
correct.
See
at
her.
Mercy in Durango.
She's probably informing some of Janelle's attributes then.
She is, and my wife is a tremendous reader. She is much more of a nonfiction reader, but she is a good critique, and she's been particularly good for me in terms of helping me with the medical portions of what invariably occur when you're talking about exciting kind of plot-driven fiction. You've got travails going on, you've got injuries occurring,
right.
and murders occurring, and she's been really good at helping me make sure that my murders are legitimate and my injuries are legitimate. So
right.
So she's been really great in that regard.
That's great, and it is very believable.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. And you're right. I've also being able to use her and what I've seen as a spouse now with you know, it's her husband now for more than 30 years. We were together before she ever did the whole medical school residency thing. And so I've watched, you know, from the outside that medical world all these years. And so I'm using kind of what I've kind of learned by osmosis telling Janelle's story and who she's becoming as a paramedic. And again, Chuck's the same way. As an archaeologist, we, all of us here in the Four Corners, tend to pick up a lot of archaeology almost by osmosis.
Right.
And I've gone off and actually taken the state of Colorado's intro to archaeology class that comes through various towns in Colorado on a regular basis to create volunteer archaeologists who are then certified and qualified to go work on archaeological digs. So I've taken the intro course to that to try to get beyond just the osmosis to learning kind of the nuts and bolts of archaeology that I can then share with readers through Chuck.
And the way he talks about how what is found, where it's found.
Right, precisely. That's something that again, as I try to introduce mystery readers, you know, nationwide or worldwide, to kind of the treasures that we have out here in the West, because so far the series has stayed, probably likely will stay out here in the West, and to their value, and to particularly their value if you don't have people who are picking things up when they shouldn't be picking them up. And in fact,
right.
a couple of the earlier books have dealt more closely with the whole issue of pot hunting, the problems that then accrue when that sort of stuff is going on.
Is there a place that the listeners can go to check out your website or something?
Yep, that's the simplest way to go is just to go to scottfranklingraham.com. So I'm Scott Graham, but of course that one was taken, and so we all have to get our longer names to get our website
right.
these days. And my middle name is Franklin, like Ben Franklin, so it's basically just all one word, scottfranklingraham.com. And from there will be links to my publisher. There will be links to pick up the book from independent bookstores, if you wish, or from
mm-hmm.
Amazon.
Okay, scottfranklingraham.com. Well,
That's
been
correct.
great talking to you, Scott, and I look forward to the next two books.
Well, a pleasure talking with you too, Tracy, and I'm looking forward to writing them. Thanks.
Thank you, Scott. That was a great conversation with Scott Graham. Scott will be at Maria's Bookstore Thursday, November 8th at 6:30 p.m., facilitating a conversation with Margaret Mitsushima and Emily Littlejohn. This is Tracy Hales-Vass, right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM. You can contact me at rightonatsanjuancollege.edu. Thanks for listening.